Hello, I'm Abby Batran. I'll be presenting to you the English translation of the first episode in the Jewish History series on behalf of Rabbi Gedalia Shestak and the Jewish History Keepers Foundation. These episodes will lay out for you the history of the Jewish people from the time of the Babylonian exile up until modern day. Sit comfortably and enjoy. So let's begin. In ancient times, Jewish prophets were held in high regard by all civilized societies. Every word they uttered was heeded with the utmost attention and closely considered. People desired to be close to them, their wisdom, and their spirituality. It is said that before she gave birth to him, Pythagoras' mother undertook an arduous journey to the territory of what is now Lebanon, just so that he'd be born closer to where the Jewish prophets resided. It is said that many Greek thinkers were students of the prophets Ezekiel and Jeremiah. A prophecy that was given by Jeremiah at the very birth of the Babylonian Empire hovered over the Babylonians like the sword of Damocles, until this prophecy was finally realized. At the time when Babylon was the largest city in the world, estimated to span an area equal to ancient Rome during the rule of Emperor Augustus, the prophet Jeremiah prophesied the following. "And thus said the Lord, when Babylon is 70 years old, I will remember you and fulfill for you my good word that you will return to this place." We have already mentioned that the Jews were exiled to Babylon. In ancient times, people who were expelled from their land, as a rule, were not likely to return. To my knowledge, there are no examples of exiled peoples making a return to their homeland. Usually, exiled peoples quickly mastered their new territories, language, and customs, and tended to remain there permanently. The Jewish people were exiled to Babylon, which is essentially considered to be present-day Iraq. The largest group settled in the Babylonian city of Tel Aviv. At the beginning of the 20th century, when the first pioneers led the return of the Jewish people to Israel, they built a new city and, ironically, decided to name it Tel Aviv, probably inspired by the meaning of this name, which translates to the Hill of Spring. With spring comes rebirth, the rebirth of new life, and so on. Unfortunately, the people who chose this name were very far removed from the Jewish tradition and were unaware of the tragic meaning that Tel Aviv of Babylon had to the Jewish people who had been exiled there. Be as it may, there was that prophecy that the Jewish people would spend 70 years in exile. I must stress that 70 years is quite a long period of time. In 1987, the Soviet Union collapsed after 70 years of existence and became the Russia of today. As you can imagine, a lot can change in 70 years. The Jews who live in Russia now are very different from the Jews who lived there 70 years ago. Our ancestors spoke Yiddish and lived strictly according to Jewish tradition. In contrast, their descendants are almost completely assimilated, have forgotten Yiddish, and have a minimal connection to Jewish tradition. During the course of 70 years, much can happen and a lot can change. Indeed, 70 years is a very long time to be in exile. The exile of the Jews to Babylon was prophesied long before the destruction of the first temple. Just to clarify, I will be using widely accepted dates when referring to events that took place prior to the time of Alexander the Great, instead of what the Jewish tradition calculates. There is a disagreement over a missing period of roughly 160 years, or 169 years to be exact, and we will address this discrepancy later in greater detail. But just consider that according to the Jewish tradition, the Persian Empire existed at least 169 years less than it is thought to have existed by the common calendar. This is a discrepancy of not just a year or two, but almost of two centuries. This is a fascinating topic in and of itself, and it has been widely researched, so I won't spend too much time on it. Nonetheless, in the year 586 BC, after the destruction of the first temple, the Jews were banished to Babylon, and this marked the beginning of the Babylonian exile. As we've previously learned from the Book of Daniel, the exile happened during the course of two separate events. The first event occurred 18 years prior to the destruction of the first temple, during the reign of King Jehoiakim. Nebuchadnezzar, who had just begun his reign over the vast Babylonian Empire, invaded Jerusalem and captured King Jehoiakim along with many others, among who were the prophets Daniel and Ezekiel. The first events occurred in 604 BC, when King Nebuchadnezzar captured part of the citizens of Jerusalem and banished them to Babylon, but Jerusalem and the first temple remained intact for 18 more years. The second event unfolded after the siege and fall of Jerusalem during the rule of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah and descendant of the house of King David. On the 9th of Av, 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar's army once again invaded Jerusalem, this time leaving it in ruins, and the first temple burned to the ground. The remaining Jews were banished to Babylon. This is why I said there were really two exiles, because there were two exile events that were 18 years apart. The Babylonians were faced with a perplexing problem. They couldn't figure out from which exile event they should calculate 70 years in order to figure out the correct date their empire was prophesied to fall by the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah was widely known throughout the empire, and both the Jews and the Babylonians were fully aware of his prophecy that the Jews were to return to their homeland in 70 years after being exiled. This prophecy did not sit well with the Babylonians. We know that the last Babylonian king, who attempted to figure out when the end of the 70-year exile would be and the Babylonian Empire was to fall, calculated the wrong date. Neither he nor anyone else knew which exile event to use to calculate the correct date. When the date they erroneously calculated came to pass, and the Babylonian Empire was still going strong, the Babylonians were convinced that the said 70 years had already passed, and so the prophecy was not realized, and they could stop worrying. They thought the Jews could return to their homeland only if Babylon fell. They were now convinced their empire would last forever. The Jews were also perplexed about how to correctly calculate their prophesied return to their homeland. Counting plus 70 years from the first exile event, which took place in the year 604 BC, when King Jehoiakim was in power, it would mean that the end of their exile would be in the year 534 BC. However, if you count plus 70 years from the second exile event, which occurred 18 years later, in the year of 586 BC, when the first temple was destroyed, then the end of the exile would be in the year 516 BC. As you can imagine, this was a conundrum for both the Jews and the Babylonians alike. Nevertheless, with each passing year, the Jewish people got 1 year closer to the date that would mark the end of their 70-year exile, so that they could return to their homeland. But before we continue with our story, you may be curious to know what the world looked like to our Jewish ancestors 2,500 years ago. So let's get into our time machine and travel back some 2,500 years. As we visit each destination, don't be alarmed if nothing looks familiar. As a matter of fact, all the great destinations of Europe simply did not yet exist. If we were to visit Russia of 2,500 years ago, we wouldn't run into any Slavs in Moscow. We might see some Finno-Ugric tribes that were known to inhabit this area at a later period, but we would definitely see a lot of trees. We wouldn't fare any better in Ukraine, Poland, or Germany. We would surely not find any semblance of civilization in England and France, because 2,500 years ago, all of Western Europe was just a dense forest, inhabited by various barbarian tribes. Italy was a bit more advanced, with a primitive civilization at best. Rome was already on the map, but was just a small town and a far cry from the empire it would later become that would rule the world. Moving on to Central Asia, we would see some city-states, but the civilization central to our story would be found in Egypt and the Middle East. Let's have a look at the peoples that lived on the territories of the Near East 2,500 years ago, and we can better understand how they influenced the course of Jewish history. Let's visit the territory of what is modern-day Turkey. If we came to Odessa, we would find nothing there, as the first Greek city-states we'd expect to be there were not yet established. Although we might see a random Greek colony or a settlement on the territory of what is modern-day Crimea, but overall, this area was mostly unsettled and inhabited by a nomadic people. So even if we were to make our way out of all the dense forests and arrive in the Crimea by way of Moscow and manage not to get slaughtered by the nomads, and somehow made it to a Greek city-state along the Black Sea, and got on a ship and sailed to modern-day Turkey, the first thing that would surprise us when we got there is that there aren't any Turks in Turkey, and that's because that territory was inhabited by a completely different people. So, what people lived in Asia Minor and Turkey 2,500 years ago when there were no countries, only city-states? It wasn't the Kurds, they didn't exist then. Indeed, they were neither the Kurds, nor the Turks, nor the Arabs. The people who lived on the territory of what is modern-day Turkey were the Greeks. There was no single state, just scattered, unrelated towns. But let's move on. So Turkey borders with Iran. In the 6th century BC, a lot of tumultuous events were taking place in Iran. This territory has always been populated by Semites. The entire Middle East was home to the Babylonians, Syrians, Phoenicians, and many other descendants of Shem, who are all Semitic peoples. Around the 9th century BC, Aryan tribes began invading the territory. These were very different people than the Semites. The Aryan tribes were settling in the territories of modern-day Tajikistan and Iran, and formed a state called Media, with its capital Ecbatana. This was a distinctly Aryan state with Aryan people. On a curious note, prior to 1935, Iran was called Persia. When the ruler of Persia, Shah Reza, decided to change the name of his country, he was in negotiations with the Germans. The name change was decided on after the Germans enlightened the Shah that Persia is not the correct name for his country, and since his people were Aryan, the country should be called Iran, which means Aryan in Persian. So you see, Iran is the country of the Aryans. Meanwhile, the Germans, who are totally unrelated to the Aryans, had been hard at work developing their Aryan ideology. Indeed, the Iranians were Aryans, and so are the Tajiks, but the Germans are not. That was just their wishful thinking. So, in 8th century BC, as various Aryan tribes were settling in Media, in the capital city Ecbatana, yet another Aryan tribe called the Pasargadae invaded Media. The leader of this semi-nomadic tribe was Achaemenid. For centuries to come, the Pasargadae would be ruled by his descendants, all called Achaemenid. Media was a vast country with numerous vassal states and territories, with a fragmented population of Aryan tribes, Pasargadae, and others. Enter Assyria on the world arena. It conquered both Media and Babylon, but not long afterward, Assyria's bubble burst and the fight over who picks up the spoils was on. The Middle East was being torn apart by two giant countries. Babylon seized the territories of modern-day Iran, Syria, Israel, and more, while Media took control of the territories where the Aryans had settled. Since Egypt had been in decline by the 6th century BC, the Middle East was dominated by diverse ethnic groups. The Aryan enclave in the region of modern-day Iran, called Media, and various Semitic tribes in Babylon. Our tale begins during this period in history. 100 years later, Herodotus would study throughout these lands. He interviewed anyone who still had memories of Egypt, spoke to Egyptian priests, to Persians in Persia, gathered detailed information, and recorded the data. The historical account that Herodotus handed down to us reads like a fairy tale. No one knows for certain what is fact and what is fiction. It has become legend. The king of Media was a man by the name of Astyages, ethnically an Aryan, to be precise, a Mede. Astyages did not produce any sons. Daughter Mandana was his only offspring. This posed a problem, since according to Median law, only a son could be an heir to the throne. But luckily, there was a way to work around this. If his daughter married and produced a son, then he could be the next king of Media. Preoccupied with this issue, Astyages had a strangely perverse dream. In this dream, his daughter Mandana was relieving herself and causing the whole world to drown in her urine. Back in those days, dreams were not taken lightly. Astyages awoke in a cold sweat and sent for the priests, demanding they explain what this dream symbolized. The priest told Astyages that this dream may not bode particularly well for him. It foretold that Astyages' future grandson would take over the whole civilized world. On the one hand, Astyages thought this may be a good thing. Media was a sizable country, but smaller than Babylon. Astyages foolishly believed that he could control destiny. He just needed to do something about Mandana. He must marry her off to someone who would not be able to claim his throne. He decided that a man by the name of Cambyses would be a safe choice. Cambyses was a descendant of Achaemenid from the Pasargadae tribe. So off Mandana goes to the region that will later be called Persia, the name likely derived from the name of the Pasargadae tribe. The Pasargadae were Aryans and vassals of Media. So Mandana marries and soon after conceives. As her due date fast approached, her father Astyages, the king of Media, in the illustrious city of Ecbatana, saw yet another dream, no less realistic and much more frightening. This time, he dreams that his daughter Mandana is lounging, and from her belly sprouts a grapevine. The grapevine grows and engulfs the whole world. Astyages awakens in a cold sweat. Anxious to have his dream decoded, he sends for the priests. The priests explained, "It means that your daughter is about to give birth to a son that is destined to conquer all the territories, starting with the ones under your rule." Being a man with a seemingly fragile psyche, Astyages felt that having a grandson is theoretically a positive thing, but he fretted about what would happen when he, Astyages, grows weaker with age. Would it be off with Grandpa's head, and the grandson grabs his throne and kingdom? He wasn't far off the mark, because that was the norm in those days. Without further consideration, Astyages sends for a trusted aide named Garpak. Astyages gives him the following order. "When my daughter Mandana gives birth, you must switch the baby with one that is deceased, or simply tell her that her baby died at birth." How could this be accomplished? In those days, the newborn was taken away right after birth to increase the mother's chance of surviving, so that she could rest and recover. Wouldn't this be like shooting oneself in the foot? I guess so. It would mean Astyages doesn't have an heir, but this was better than being dethroned. Anyhow, Garpak takes the newborn and heads to the mountains of Ekbatana, in a very mountainous region of Iran. On his way, Garpak encounters a shepherd and tells him all about the king's secret plan. He gives the infant to the shepherd and insists that this baby must not survive, and says, "Carry out this task in any manner you wish, but you must bring proof of the outcome." So the shepherd went off with the baby, not knowing what to do. He returned to his dwelling just as his wife was giving birth to their child, who was stillborn. He recounted his meeting with the king's aide, Garpak, and handed the infant to her. The wife suggested that they keep this baby and show their dead infant as proof that the shepherd carried out his assignment. The shepherd agreed. So the infant stayed with the shepherd and his wife, and they named him Cyrus, or Koresh, as he is known in the Bible. If you rearrange the letters in the name Koresh, you get the word kosher. Our sages say that Koresh was a kosher human being, and we'll learn later on what this Persian king did to earn such a high distinction. In any event, the shepherd brings the proof to Garpak, who shows it to the king Astyages. Everyone is content with the outcome, but for Mandana, she is grieving, not knowing that her son is alive and growing up in the shepherd's household. As the years went by and Koresh turned 10 years old, a pivotal event occurred. In a settlement not far from Ekbatana, a group of children were at play. We don't know for sure what game they were playing, but one that required someone to play the king. All the kids, with one exception, chose Koresh. This kid, who was the offspring of a very important dignitary, said that he would not obey a king who is the son of a shepherd. Koresh, who was already in character as the king, declared, "This is a revolt! Seize him and execute him!" The boy scuffled and roughed up the troublemaker a bit. He ran home crying and told his dignitary father about what had happened and how the son of a shepherd was chosen to play the king. The next day, Astyages held a feast and asked for an update of what was going on in the kingdom. The dignitary replied, "You won't believe what the commoners are doing. My son was beat up by a shepherd's son who declared himself king." Anyone else would have made nothing of it, but, being slightly paranoid, Astyages took this very seriously. He ordered that the 10-year-old Koresh be brought before him. Astyages looked him over. He noticed a resemblance to himself and his daughter Mandana. Astyages got very anxious and demanded to know, "Who is your father?" The boy replied that his father is just a shepherd. So Astyages called for the shepherd for questioning. "Is this your son?" The shepherd replied, "Yes, of course." But Astyages had a nagging feeling that the shepherd wasn't telling him something. He says, "We'll get you to talk." In those days, they had very creative ways of getting information out of people. Recall when Nebuchadnezzar threatened to have the prophet Daniel quartered, salted, and fed to him. As you see, back then, no one was concerned about human rights, and the shepherd didn't stand a chance. He confessed. Realizing that he was duped, King Astyages invited Garpak to dinner. As Garpak was feasting on all the delicacies, Astyages asked him if he was enjoying his meal. Garpak replied, "I've never eaten anything so delicious. What kind of meal is this?" Astyages ordered the servants to bring out the platter with the leftovers. As Garpak was swallowing his last mouthful, he almost choked because on that platter were the head and feet of his own son. But Garpak, being of true Median character, didn't even flinch. He immediately understood that he was being punished for deceiving the king. The nagging question of what to do about Koresh once again arose. Astyages called on the priests for guidance. The priests advised Astyages to let Koresh live because he no longer posed a threat to his throne. The priests reassured Astyages that the prophecy foretelling that Koresh would be king already came to pass because Koresh had already had his reign as king in a kid's game. On the advice of the priests, Astyages let the boy live and sent him off to live among the Pasargadae tribe in his father's native land, where all were shocked to learn the boy was alive. The years rolled on, and Koresh was coming of age, but his grandfather, King Astyages, was declining and was almost completely inadequate as king. Koresh realized that someone needs to do something about Grandpa. Garpak was of the same sentiment after Astyages served him his son's head on a platter. So they staged a coup to remove Astyages from the throne, and Koresh became the new king of Media. In Hebrew, the word for Media is Madai. Koresh was from the Pasargadae tribe, for which the Hebrew word is Paras. Madai and Paras, Media and Persia, two Aryan lands. Let's get to know Koresh a little better. He had a way of doing things which was very different from what was the norm in ancient times. You could say it was his calling card. In those days, a dethronement was followed by a customary beheading. When Koresh dethroned his maniacal grandfather, he took a different approach. He appointed Astyages as ruler over a nearby region. So, thanks to his grandson's unprecedented act of kindness, Astyages was able to live out his years with some power and wealth intact. Koresh continues to conquer neighboring territories. He first focuses his attention on the territory of modern-day Turkey, which was inhabited by the Greeks living in random city-states. He proceeds to annex each city-state one by one. Ironically, the Greeks were quite snobbish back then. They referred to non-Greek speakers as barbarians. This word is derived from an ancient Greek word meaning babbler. They felt everyone should speak their Hellenistic language. Since the Persians spoke a language that was not understood by the Greeks, it made them barbarians, and vice versa. Persia had a very advanced civilization before the Greeks did. In any event, Koresh continued to expand his empire. He invaded a city ruled by the wealthiest man of that time named Seus. There was even a Greek saying, as wealthy as Seus. After Koresh conquers the city, he again spares its ruler. He consistently spared everyone whom he conquered. This was truly unprecedented in the ancient world. He was considered more like a liberator than a conqueror. This was his calling card. He deposed tyrants and appointed the locals to govern themselves, allowed them to continue speaking their native language and bow to the gods of their choice. Koresh was the first to implement such modern ideas in the ancient world. In one of Herodotus' accounts, after Koresh conquered Seus, a city of great riches, his soldiers began looting. Seus and Koresh looked on from atop the city walls. As Seus calmly observed, Koresh asked, "Why are you so unmoved when your riches are being stolen right before your eyes?" Seus replied, "This is your money now." After realizing Seus was right, Koresh stopped the looting. Next, Koresh turned his attention to Babylon, an enormous empire, starting to come apart at the seams. Koresh decides to do only what Koresh can do, invade Babylon, and strangely enough, he succeeds. Babylon was a gigantic city with fortifications such that no army in the world had been able to penetrate. The city was stocked with provisions that would last for decades, and there was an endless supply of water from the Tigris River, which in those days flowed through Babylon. There was another advantage. In the event of an enemy attack, the river water could be diverted around the city walls, turning the city into an island. Babylon, fully insulated by the walls and the river, was untouchable. Koresh had a solution, an idea no one else could have possibly thought of. The Tigris River flowed under the city walls. The water was more than 13 feet deep. There was a small arc-shaped opening in the city walls where the river flowed, but it was not possible to get through it. So what did Koresh do? For several weeks in complete secrecy, he dug canals. He equipped them with special diverters so that at the right moment, the river could be drained. Late one evening, when the last Babylonian king, Belshazzar, was hosting a big feast, Koresh put his plan into action. The diverters were raised and the water drained. Taking the Babylonians by surprise, Koresh and his army walked into Babylon without much resistance. Koresh is now king of Babylon as well. He proclaimed that he came to liberate, not to destroy. You probably know that all royalty are somehow related. Koresh was the grandnephew of the king, so even though he was a very distant relative, he still had a right to the throne. "I come as a liberator. I will not harm you. I will not demolish your city. I will be a just ruler, and everything that was stolen will be returned." Babylon committed heinous crimes, looted the people of conquered countries, brought them to Babylon, and enslaved them. "I am here as a liberator," said Koresh. Thus, all people that were ever held captive may now return to their homelands. It's like comparing Koresh to Gorbachev. There was an evil empire, Babylon, feared by all. Enter a man who doesn't destroy. Instead, he offers freedom, total freedom, to all captive people. Koresh was rightfully greeted as a liberator. Koresh and his descendants will create the largest empire of the ancient world, even larger than the Roman Empire. The empire which Koresh built was based on very different principles. It wasn't like Assyria, massacre everyone, steal everything. It wasn't like in Babylon, force the people out of their homeland and enslave them, leaving their homelands empty and abandoned. Now there was a wise ruler that told everyone to return to their homelands. Historically, we don't know of any people who returned to their homeland except one. Daniel was still living during the time period we are talking about. He was very old. 52 years had passed from the time the temple was destroyed. The time hasn't come for the prophecy to be realized, but from the time when Jehoiakim, Daniel, and the prophet Ezekiel were taken, the time of the first imprisonment, exactly 70 years have passed. And this is precisely when Koresh appears. Daniel shows Koresh Isaiah's prophecy, who lived more than 200 years prior. The prophecy starts with the words, "When King Koresh liberates the Jewish people." Koresh sees this 200-year-old prophecy. This isn't like Nostradamus prophecies, which can be interpreted in many different ways. Isaiah's prophecy is clearly stated. Daniel shows the words of the prophet Jeremiah, also 70 years. They are expiring just now. And Koresh, being, as our sages say, a kosher person, took this very seriously. In one of his first decrees in the year 538 BC, Koresh lets the Jewish people return to their homeland. Return of the Jews to their homeland. How was it realized? It was very similar to Perestroika in the former USSR. Prior to Perestroika, Jews were not allowed to leave the Soviet Union. And, as if out of nowhere, Gorbachev comes on the scene and announces that everyone who wishes may now go to Israel. But people were hesitant. Should they leave or stay? Life in the USSR equals bad. Life in Israel equals good. Many people decided to leave because their life in the Soviet Union was hard. There were ration cards for food, and toilet paper was a rarity. The people who immigrated to Israel for this reason earned the moniker the Sausage Aliyah. They were motivated by food and other comforts. I remember when we arrived in Australia and went food shopping at a supermarket. The selection of food was abundant. At the time, I was already keeping kosher and ironically couldn't buy anything anyway. But it's easy to understand the motivation of people who are deprived of basic food items such as sausage and how they would be losing their minds when they saw that everything they were deprived of and much more was now available to them. So these people didn't have a very good life in the Soviet Union, but in Israel, life was good. That's the reason why a lot of people left when Gorbachev allowed it. In the Soviet Union, you're called a filthy Jew. But in Israel, you're in the Jewish homeland. And a mass exodus ensued. In Babylon, the situation was exactly the opposite. During 70 years of exile, the quality of life for the Jews was like in the USA. Life in Babylon for the Jews was very good. Not just good, but very good. Yes, of course, Nebuchadnezzar was a savage, destroying the temple, expelling the Jews to Babylon, but at the same time, he didn't really oppress them much and allowed them to run their businesses and to live life as they wished. The Jews worked in the ancient day version of the banking business and lived very comfortably, much like American Jews. What was going on in Israel? Israel was in ruins. The temple was in ruins. Among the ruins were remains of the dead who couldn't have been properly buried. Jerusalem was a hill of ruins and remnants of buildings for 52 years. The whole land of Israel lay in ruins, and all of this happened in 52 years? Similar to what happened in present-day Israel, a vacuum doesn't stay vacant for long. Israel couldn't stay vacant for 52 years either. Who started moving in? Other various peoples. These peoples have now been living there for 52 years and have never seen any Jews on this land. The second and third generations felt they had always lived on this land. These people did not have a unified country, and no one could care less about a unified Jerusalem, etc. The land of Israel then resembled Israel at the turn of the 20th century, populated by Bedouin tribes, Arabs, and little infrastructure. But in contrast, life in Babylon was good, very good. And all of a sudden, Koresh announces that the Jewish people may return. Well, the Jewish people started hesitating. Was it worth going back? All of the Jews were devout, but they started weighing their options. The Jews reasoned, return where? There is Jeremiah's prophecy telling what will happen in 70 years from the destruction of the temple, but so far, only 52 years have passed. So it's not the right time to return. There are 18 more years to go. And what are we returning for? Our life is good. Why give it up? Nevertheless, this unrest hadn't yet taken hold of the Jewish peoples, but some reforms began. These reforms were akin to the ones in the USSR at the end of the 80s. Glasnost, Perestroika. All of a sudden, the king, whom everyone regarded as a liberator, announced that all peoples may return to their homeland. The Babylonians called David Belshazzar, but the Persian arrived and called him Sheshbazzar. In these various cultures, many people aren't able to pronounce certain names and opt to change them so they are easier to pronounce. When Daniel arrived, if you recall the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Your name is no longer Daniel. It's hard to pronounce. You'll now be called Belshazzar." When the Persians arrived, they asked, "What's your name?" "Belshazzar." It's too hard to pronounce. Now you'll be called Sheshbazar. So Daniel became Sheshbazar. He was already advanced in his years. Maybe a silly comparison, he was like the Sakharov of that time. He's been the one the Jewish people looked up to during all the years in exile. Daniel gets invited to the palace, and Koresh treats him with enormous respect and piety. Koresh says to Sheshbazar, "Our sages say it's Daniel. Return to the land of Israel." But the people are still pondering if they should return or not. Sheshbazar will be the first to return. "What should we do, Daniel?" The treasures that belonged to the temples had been stored away. Nebuchadnezzar didn't take all of it. The menorah was hidden. The Ark of the Covenant was hidden. The rest of the treasure was in Nebuchadnezzar's sanctuary. And Koresh, he's the Gorbachev of that time, he gives everything back. Calls on Daniel, or Sheshbazar, and says, "Go take all the temple treasure. And on top of that, I will give you a lot of money. What's your city called? Jerusalem? Go to your Jerusalem. Build a temple to the Almighty, because your God is the real deal." When Koresh was shown the prophecy, he was stunned. Sheshbazar, escorted by a group of guards, took part of the treasure. Not all of it, but most of it. Now it needed to be transported to Jerusalem. That's the reason it is written that at first the treasure was brought to a Jewish household, and then taken by Sheshbazar. Newspapers didn't exist back then, but if they did, they would have perceived like the newspapers of the 90s. The incredible happens. The legendary Daniel, the 85-year-old Daniel with the temple treasure in tow, which for 52, or by other calculations, for 70 years, has been in enemy hands, is heading back to the land of Israel. This was witnessed by everyone. There was another decree. Koresh decreed, "Every Jew, wherever he may be on the territory of the Persian Empire, may take all of his belongings, absolutely all of them, and return back to his homeland." Moreover, Koresh does what Gorbachev did. He said, since many people don't have enough money for farming, etc., he promises to give them money. This was unheard of in the ancient world, and that's when a man named Zerubbabel, who was the great-grandson or the great-great-grandson of Jehoiakim, the Jewish king, the one that was banished 70 years ago, began assembling people for their return to the land of Israel. He is a direct descendant of King David. He is the one they called Jehoshua, and who will become the high priest of the newly built temple. Zerubbabel is a very significant name, a person with the support of whom the Jewish people make their second return. The other one is Jehoshua, who will become the high priest of the second temple. In the year 538 BC, 42,360 people decided to move to Israel. Is it a large or a small number of people? How many Jews were living in Babylon? How many Jews in total were there in Babylon? Around 5 to 10 million. The settlers were heading into the unknown. Who was going? Zerubbabel and Jehoshua. Into the unknown. Who was going? The elderly, the pioneering elderly and young people that wanted to rebuild Israel. The rest were waiting to see what will happen. The people were scared. Now that Koresh is in power, all is well. But after he's gone, it may be off with our heads. Here we are settled, have homes, and everything's fine. The people start calculating if the time has really come to return. 42,360 people return. Among them were 4,289 Kohens, and only 341 Levites. Curious thing, notice the ratio. 4,289 to 341. There should have been considerably more Levites, since Levi is a tribe, but the Kohen are part of a tribe. But there were many more Kohanes returning than there were Levites. This has been the case for thousands of years. Go to any synagogue and ask if there are any Kohanes. As a rule, they are present in any synagogue, but the Levites are few. Why? Because not all returned. 341 Levites and 4,289 Kohanes. Give or take, this ratio remains. Moreover, which Levites return? Mostly the elderly and disabled Levites, not a lot of younger people. Some can still remember the temple. The Levites who sang in the temple might have been 20 years old. 52 years have passed. Now they must be 72. The old are returning as invalids. They are still able to remember Jerusalem. Like Daniel, but he's even older. He's from the first exile, from which 70 years have passed. Why are many disabled? Because their thumbs are missing. They cut them off. Psalm 137 mentioned this. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and cried. A well-known psalm, which most everyone knows. Where did they sit and cry? In which city? In Tel Aviv. The pioneers, when they chose the name Tel Aviv, had no idea of the history behind it, because they barely knew anything at all about our ancestors. By the rivers of Babylon we sat and cried. In Tel Aviv, the city in Babylon, when we remembered Zion, our lost homeland. On the willow in its midst, we hung our kinnors. What are kinnors? They are harps, which were played by the Levites. In those days, Levites were considered to be the best singers in the world. When they were musicians, they were singers and performed in the temple of Jerusalem. It was something quite extraordinary. We hung up our kinnors because our captors demanded that we sing for them and laughed at us. Sing for us a song of Zion. The Babylonians treated the Jews that same way the Nazis did in concentration camps. They demanded that the great musicians play for them. Play, they said, amuse us all, and then to the gas chambers. These were great musicians that all perished. They performed for the prisoners and the Germans. The Babylonians forced the Levites to sing in the same manner. Sing the songs of your temple for us, the one we destroyed. And every Levite cut off their finger, so that it would be impossible to play. And so, these 341 Levites, together with Zerubbabel and Jehoshua, only 42,360 people head on their journey. And Daniel is already there. He got there not long before, with the temple treasure. He arrived in Jerusalem, but there was nothing there except ruins. Nothing but ruins. And together with the guards that accompanied him and the temple treasure, he awaits for the Jews to return. And so, these 42,000 people arrive. And what do they see? Horror! The country in ruin, cities destroyed, a mixed bag of people walking about that now consider this land to be their own. My grandfather and father lived here. This is my country. That was their position. And so the Jews arrive, and part of them settle in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a pile of ruins. No city walls. If there are no city walls, then anyone can rob or kill you at nightfall. And so, to these 42,360 people, Zerubbabel says, everyone must return to the city they were banished from, or his ancestors are from. If your ancestors are from Beit Shemesh, go to Beit Shemesh. But Beit Shemesh no longer exists. It's only ruins. A few families begin rebuilding the city. But what do they do about food? They try to sow and gather the harvest, while surrounded by people watching them with suspicion. Nevertheless, the first settlers decided to do the most important thing. They understand that if they are returning to the land of Israel, then the first order of business must be to begin rebuilding the temple. On the 1st of Iyar, 538 BC, the restoration of the temple begins. The temple, which has been laying in ruin for 52 years. What was it like on the day they began rebuilding the temple? On the day they broke ground, it was like it is written in the book of Ezra. The Kohens played the trumpets. Daniel brought these trumpets, the ones that were from the first temple. The Levites, the young Levites, not the ones who lost their fingers, played the lyres and the cymbals, and they sang. The elderly watched as the temple was being rebuilt, and they cried. The young people rejoiced. When the young asked the elders why they were crying, the elders replied that they were crying because they remembered how the temple, Jerusalem, looked in the past. But now they see ruins and rubble. There weren't any workers. Building materials were now just being ordered. This temple will be different than the first temple. The youth are laughing, the old are crying, and it will be this way all throughout the 420-year history of the second temple. It will have tears and laughter and great pain. A significant part of the 420 years of the existence of the second temple will be filled with tears. The Jewish people for a big part of this time will be under foreign rule. But there will also be joy. That will come later, after 200 years, when the Hasmoneans will come and drive out the Greeks and liberate the temple, and the Jewish people will earn their independence. It was with laughter and tears. The temple that was in ruins for 52 years is being rebuilt. And at the very start of the restoration, people send letters to their homeland in Babylon. And the Mishpucha in Babylon asks, "How is life treating you in Palestine?" Of course, there wasn't a Palestine back then. "How is life in the land of Israel?" And the response is, "Difficult, very difficult. No cities, nothing, there is nothing. The infrastructure is non-existent. The civilization that was remained here, but we began rebuilding the temple." People started enthusiastically restoring the temple. So it's really the time to go. But as the Jews just began rebuilding the temple, now came the people that the Jews call Kutim and sometimes Shomronim. There were a lot of them. They lived on this territory. There were a lot of them that came to the builders. At first they came to Zerubbabel and said, "We are Jews as well. You are Jews and we are Jews. Even bigger Jews than you. It's great that you are restoring the temple. We want to help you. We will do everything to help you do this quickly. We have lots of people and will help you with everything." Zerubbabel declined. "You will not rebuild the temple." This marked the beginning of a story, which led to the events of Purim and other future events. The reconstruction of the temple will be halted for 18 years. A long and terrible 18 years. We will stop here today and resume next time. Who are the Shomronim? Why were they not allowed to help the Jews restore the temple? And what happened next? Thank you.